grandfather tell me how it was when you were young? Was the world so very old when your life had just begun?
Good afternoon and welcome to Living Permaculture on KDNK. I'm Vanessa Harmony of Colorado Edible Forest in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, joined by my co-host, Jerome Osentowski of Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute, or CRIMPI, in Basalt, Colorado. On today's program, we are honored to welcome David Lipsky of New York, New York. David Lipsky is a New York Times best-selling author whose recent nonfiction book is entitled The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial. New York Times' Zoe Schlanger describes it in her book review as, David Lipsky spins top-flight climate literature into cliffhanger entertainment. And now for my description. It's a shocking and terrifying account of humankind's roller coaster ride, starting at the invention of the telegraph, the light bulb, and electrical current, to the shockwave of inventions and consumer products those created, to the voices of science and reason that pleaded in the ears of society and politicians to take action against the negative impacts industry was having on human health and climate, and the sociopathic greed of naysaying bullies who built a culture of clouding the truth by sullying scientists' reputations and creating false self-serving mimics of the truth. And finally, the heart-sinking anticlimax when climate change scientists finally achieve redemption and affirmation, but human weaknesses either obstruct or belittle or skirt opportunities to take meaningful action. I wish I could say I was spoiling the ending there, but we're all here living and breathing and listening in our current reality. So now I'm going to reach deep inside to pull out my positivity and optimism and offer David Lipsky a warm welcome to our program. David, thank you for being with us.
Vanessa, Jerome, thanks for having me. That's the best description of the book I've ever heard. I think you must have heard my awed surprise in the background. It's like, wow, I could never have done that, but that's the book.
All right, well, we can publish that if you like.
Awed gratitude. Anyway, please.
I was born right at the tail end of Generation X. So when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, the first environmental scare that kept me up at night was the depletion of the ozone layer.
Of course.
It was a marvel that international lawmakers were able to come together so quickly to implement a solution. Reading your book, I was surprised to find out warnings about global warming were already scientifically researched and published as early as 1956. I feel like it wasn't until I was in college that I learned about the topic of global warming and climate change. David, can you summarize the on-again, off-again role climate change played in global media starting in the 50s?
Sure, that's no small order. Thank you, Vanessa. It's a fascinating thing. So that the one of the things that the lying scientists who you so perfectly summarized before, one of the things they tried to do is make it seem like this was sort of fringy science, or it was like fringe grudges masquerading as science. But the people who began to understand in the 19th century that carbon dioxide works basically like a thermostat were always, almost comically so, the leading scientists of their nations. So that a man named Joseph Fourier was the first person to realize something in our atmosphere was keeping it warm, and that was 1824. He's France. And then John Tyndall, who was the leading scientific light of his Victorian era in England, he worked out that the two constituents that help to hold the Earth's heat and that allow us to live, he worked that out in 1859. He had a great quote. He said that were it not for carbon dioxide and water vapor, if they suddenly disappeared, the sun would rise tomorrow on an England held in the iron grip of frost. And then in 1895, published in 1896, the leading Swedish scientist, a man named Svante Arrhenius, who would become the first Swede to receive the Nobel and then would go on to lead the Nobel Labs, and a few years before he died would be described in the New York Times as perhaps the most famous scientist alive. He worked out that carbon dioxide, if you lowered it, this is where the thermostat metaphor comes from, if you lowered it, if you halved it, you would kind of bring back the ice ages. And if you doubled it, you would raise temperatures on Earth between about 5 and 11 degrees. The weird thing about he had to work that out with pencil and paper. His prediction has more or less held as they've brought stronger and stronger microchips to bear on this particular equation. It seems like he's more or less right. So Arrhenius was happy, Vanessa, to know about that because he's from Sweden and it's cold. And in fact, scientists tend to always group with other scientists. I think those are the most fun people for them to talk to. And so the scientific society that he belonged to, other top flight scientists, they were like, hey, it's so cold here. Why wait? Why wait the many centuries that it will take for carbon dioxide to accumulate? Let's find some old coal mines that have more or less been mined out, and let's set them on fire now so that the extra smoke will warm up Sweden for our generation. Why should we wait a few hundred years? The reason that they thought that was that, just to teach two science terms to our listeners, the basic way our atmosphere cleanses itself, the two elements that do that are called sinks. And on land, the sink for removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere is trees. Trees eat carbon dioxide and sunlight, and they excrete oxygen. But the larger sink on the water is the ocean, which by Arrhenius' calculation was going to remove about half, just speaking broadly, and I'm using the numbers from the 50s, but it was going to remove about 9/10 of the new carbon dioxide. And so people thought from 1896, when Arrhenius published his findings in an English scientific journal, until the mid-1950s, people thought, okay, carbon dioxide does that work, but we don't have to worry about it because the oceans are, you know, effectively limitless and they will process the carbon dioxide for us. However, people had been noticing that the climate was getting warmer. And so that was already a fairly large issue in the 50s, even before 1956. In the years before that, the New York Times ran about a dozen stories about carbon dioxide. And they read as if the newspaper is having like a mumbling argument with itself. Is the climate changing? These are the headlines. No, the climate is not changing. Is the climate changing again? Yes, the climate is changing. Are old timers right that the climate is changing? How industry can change climate? And finally, yes, the climate really is changing. So in 1956, America's most famous oceanographer, and again, it's just mainstream scientists, Roger Revelle had helped. He'd worked for the Office of Naval Intelligence. He helped start the Bureau of Ships. He had read the work of a British scientist named G.S. Callender, and Callender is now known as the first person to do the equations that showed that the warming had started in the 1920s and 30s. And so he wanted to disprove Callender in the mid-50s because people were wondering why things were warmer. And he was working with a colleague, and they began to disprove that carbon dioxide was warming the climate now. And then Revelle remembered what he had learned by testing the waters around Bikini Atoll. He was there for the hydrogen bomb tests. And it wasn't whether the water would process the carbon dioxide, whether it would absorb the carbon dioxide. The question was, would it hold it? And he ran the equations, and he realized it wouldn't. And it's a weird thing. In the paper he was writing, you can see how surprising that was. The last part of the paper is scotch-taped in, so that he'd been surprised by this outcome. And so that was in 1956. That year, he spoke to Tom, and this was really a shock to me. It's one of the reasons that I wanted to tell this great story. What he said was, in 50 years or so, this could have a violent effect on the Earth's climate. And while he was publishing in the scientific journals, that was in Time magazine, and the headline wasn't subtle either. The headline was, One Big Greenhouse. And the same year, and this is where the parrot in the title of the book comes from, another scientist, not connected to Revelle, but noticing the same changes in the makeup of the atmosphere, a man named Gilbert Plass, also a scientist working with the Navy. There he was working at the High Altitude Research Center at Johns Hopkins. He was getting the same figures, and in October of that same year, in October of 1956, The New York Times summarized his research, and it is what we know about how global warming works today. And the Times summarized it, and they said, centuries from now, when it really begins to click in, the Arctic regions will be changed to tropical jungles with tigers roaming in the underbrush and gaudy parrots squawking from the trees. Revelle knew that he had to test whether we were generating this extra carbon dioxide. If he was right, it would be measurable. And he hired a very gifted postdoc named Charles David Keeling, who had figured out a way to effectively measure the carbon dioxide makeup of the atmosphere. And sure enough, every year it was going up. And there are two ways that science, both externally and internally, responded to that. What Keeling would always tell reporters is, when it was going up the fourth year, we knew something was going on. Among scientists, the American Institute of Physics has a great project where they're just telling the history of their discipline. And a fellow scientist, the way he put it was, by the fourth year, it was pathetic. It was so clear that we were changing the atmosphere.
Well, there were so many times in the book where I was cheering for what seemed like the great successes for the climate change researchers, and thinking that they, for sure, that people were going to believe them that time. But just when you thought the hero had succeeded, another monster obstacle would pop out. So speaking of some...
That is the weird history of this story is, I kept thinking of it. Did you ever see Jaws, Vanessa?
I never went back and watched Jaws, no, because it came out...
So you only saw it the first time when you were a kid, and
exactly.
People were saying, hey, there's a water hazard, but you haven't gone back. If you go back and check it, it is a great movie about global warming, which is the captain of that town keeps saying, hey, there's a shark. And the people who run the town, since the town is a resort town, they keep pressing him to change the cause of death from shark attack to something like boating accident, because they need to not notice it, basically.
Wow. So it's like a metaphor for climate change.
If you watch it, you will smile to yourself. It is an accidentally perfect metaphor.
Well, that's good that we can make some fun metaphors about this challenging topic. It's surprising and disturbing how cigarettes and secondhand smoke got wrapped up or rolled up with climate change. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. Essentially, they had a common enemy. So, in three ways that were, again, shocking. And I would also love, if there's time, to go back to when, because what you were saying was we were both trying to remember when we first heard about it. And to me, it's fascinating and it's a great story, but it's a terrible missed opportunity when our government was aware of this potential problem. The cigarette industry did a few things. First, it roughed out the gameplay. So it's like they invented the best industrial defense against data that you don't like, which is not exactly to attack the scientists, but A, to ask for more research. Think about it. If someone says, I totally disagree, we don't really trust them. We know they have an axe to grind. But if they say, great, please tell us more, it's like Judah. We just want to be sure before we stop having cigarettes. Second thing is, when they realized they had known since the late 40s, their own research showed them that there was a causal connection between smoking and lung cancer. In the 50s, scientists they began to nose their way towards it too. So they had to figure out the best way to fight it, and the way they determined to fight it, they were helped in this by the most clever public relations brains of the era. Their idea is, A, stress the research, but B, and this is something that conservative politicians learned at the end of the most recent century, Gallup polling showed that at that time people were most willing to trust scientists, and that's something that apparently was well known in the public affairs community, so that the tobacco industries were counseled by the high-priced talent they brought into the room, just find a scientist. We need to have a human face saying we need to have more research. Third way is they trained The same kinds of people who are willing to lie about the effect that carbon dioxide has on the climate for money, they are people who are willing to take a check, to take a donation, to lie about other things. So many of the main voices that the Republicans used in their approach to delaying action on this were people who had first been recruited and trained. In a way, you could look at the tobacco denial as like the preseason for global warming. And then fourth, and this was the wildest part of the story, the EPA, the basic fear for the tobacco industry was that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, would classify secondhand smoke, cigarette smoke, which the tobacco industry, God, the people in these jobs are so clever, they tried to change the phrase secondhand smoke to environmental tobacco smoke because, you know, it's nobody's fault. It's just the trees and the hills are smoking cigarettes. That's where the smoke is coming from, not from somebody buying Marlboro Lights. But what they understood was that in America, if someone chooses to smoke, we don't step in and say, you can't do that to yourself. But that the idea of secondhand smoke, which is if you choose to smoke and then it gives me cancer because I'm on an airplane next to you or I'm working at the next desk, that was going to be the big problem for them. And they had lived in fear of that for about a decade. And in the mid-80s, the EPA declared secondhand smoke a Class A carcinogen. And so the cigarette industry understood, and what they wrote in their memos was that our main objective is to discredit the EPA. And so they began funding climate deniers for the classic transitive principle. If you could show they were wrong about things like ozone, and especially about things like global warming, if the EPA looked wrong about that, then maybe they were wrong about cigarettes. And so they put a huge amount of their resources into making the EPA look like, as they put it, terrorists, government terrorists. And that elevated the profiles of the denial scientists, and it correspondingly lowered the trust people had in the EPA.
Right.
Well, it must be fun digging up all of this stuff, because as an investigative journalist, you have to get out your deep digging forks, don't you? find all this stuff out, get down into the dirt, and there may be even some trenching. every book that's in an investigative journal, this pattern just keeps coming up, doesn't it? I mean, the same thing. There's this good side, and there's the evil side, and you hire the scientists, you pay them off, you hire the public relations men, you hire the lawyers, and the battle goes on. I mean, I've been in that. It's whether it's zoning, whether it's herbicide spraying, it's all the same. It's just these two sides always juggling, and everybody's making money. They're all enablists. I'd say, well, you have to side with somebody. The good side, I'd say, are doing the good thing. But there's always somebody doing the other side.
Right. So speaking of which, did you encounter any roadblocks or negative pressure when you were writing this book or after, David?
No, the difficulty really was just what Jerome was saying, which is finding the material and then also not letting yourself get so angry that you couldn't write the book.
Right.
But no, there were no the really interesting thing about this also, and I wonder if this is you guys' impression. One of the things that was disturbing to me was that in the 1970s, do you know, Vanessa and Jerome, how if you have a promising new drug, it takes about 10 or 20 years to take it through the approval process, just because we want to make sure it's safe. With science, it's kind of not that different. So that when Roger Revelle was saying, hey, you know, carbon dioxide is accumulating and that's going to start causing warming, took about 10 or 20 years for the rest of the scientific community to begin assessing this claim and to begin checking and following Charles Keeling's what then came to be known as the Keeling curve, which in science circles and also in Weather Channel circles, the Weather Channel was doing one of those anniversary things where they were saying the biggest weather moments and, you know, 50 biggest weather moments. And number one, it beat out the formation of the EPA and also predicting the tides and stuff like that at Normandy. Number one was the day that Keeling, that Charles David Keeling started keeping the Keeling curve.
Wow.
Because that number, which keeps going up on an annual basis, is what was generating a lot of scientific investigation. So that by the mid-70s, 20 years after Revel published, he published his stuff in 1957, so 18 years after, these big reports started coming in. The first National Academy of Sciences report came in 1977, and it wasn't subtle. They were saying this is going to start happening in the next 5 or 10 years. Like, we have to start dealing with this now. And the head of the Department of Energy was saying this is potentially the biggest environmental problem facing the world. And if what we think is true, we'll make big changes and fast. And then there kept being more reports. Vanessa and Jerome, did you guys see that movie Oppenheimer?
I did. Did you?
Ah, okay. So, well, Vanessa, we found a movie. but Oppenheimer is about the Manhattan Project, which you get great scientific talent together and you set them a problem. And the Manhattan Project obviously gave us the atomic bomb, and it also gave us radar. And radar, of course, is the basis for our commercial air travel industry, too. You can't have air traffic without radar. Anyway, about 10 years after the war was over, some people in the defense community were like, hey, you know, they did great work for us during World War II. Let's get the band together, back together. So they reformed and they added new talent as a group called Jason. And the Jasons are the main scientific voice for, they're like Nobels and Nobel hopefuls. And they're the scientific voice for the defense and intelligence communities. They're the reasons that we didn't use atomic weapons in the Vietnam conflict. And they also began suggesting a combination of weaponry and digital technology so that the Iron Dome in Israel is a predictable outcropping of the work they began doing in the 60s. In the middle 70s, they also were researching this. And they presented their report in the spring of 1979. And again, even though they were a secret group, the chairman of their report was quoted in the New York Times, and he said, the effects of this will start to be felt by the 1990s. Government must begin dealing with this immediately. So the President Carter's White House did what you do when you get a report like that, and also the other reports that were coming in. They turned to the National Academy of Sciences, started by President Lincoln, by the way, and they said, his White House asked them a simple question, is this going to happen? We need to know. And the National Academy of Sciences formed a new panel, so it wouldn't be people who had a stake in this being right or in this being wrong. And they reported back quickly. And what they wrote, they reported back 44 years ago, or rather 45 years ago this July, they wrote back, the reports of this brief but intense investigation will be reassuring to scientists, because scientists, like anybody else, don't like to be proven wrong, reassuring to scientists but disturbing to policymakers. If the carbon dioxide increase continues, this panel finds no reason to doubt that climate changes will occur and no reason to believe those changes will be negligible. That was received by the White House July 29th, 1979, and we didn't take action. So, Jerome, one of the weird things about the story is we can point to the deniers and say it's you guys and it's not us, but at every level, we decided let's be like the mayor in Jaws who knows there's a shark. Let's see if we can get away with not taking action on this, because the deal that we get from fossil fuels is so good, we don't exactly want to rock the boat.
Right. And I was surprised to learn that George Bush Sr. was actually an environmental hero for a while.
I was so flattered by what the New York Times book review, by what Zoe Schlanger wrote. It is, but the story itself is a cliffhanger story. What Vanessa is talking about is that the first President Bush, his Secretary of State was a man named Jim Baker, who was powerful the way David Axelrod or James Carville is powerful. He'd been the brain trust for President Reagan. And even though President Reagan was very much an anti-environmentalist president, Jim Baker was in his White House reading the reports that kept coming in. The Reagan White House tried to stop the reports, but they kept being generated. So while President Reagan was against any action on the environment, including the terrible ozone story, Jim Baker was reading the scientific, he was reading the reports, and he was like, oh, this is clearly true. So that when President Bush was elected, they both wanted to take action. And President Bush was, by 1991, was going to become the first national leader to express, to generate and settle on specific limits on carbon dioxide emissions. And his chief of staff, a man named John Sununu, was very much against it. And he read the speech and tore it up and wrote his own speech and forced that to become White House policy.
Jeez.
Yeah, that was a tremendous surprise to me, too.
That's part one of our interview with David Lipsky. David Lipsky is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine and a contributing essayist to NPR's All Things Considered. He's the author of the novel The Art Fair, A Collection of Stories, $3,000, the best-selling nonfiction book Absolutely American, which was a Time magazine best book of the year, and Although Of Course You End Up Becoming Yourself, A Road Trip with David Foster Wallace, which was a New York Times bestseller and an NPR Best Book of the Year. David Lipsky's latest nonfiction book, which we discussed today, is called The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial, published by W.W. Norton and Company in 2023. Thank you to our listeners for joining us today. I'm your host, Vanessa Harmony of Colorado Edible Forest in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, joined by my co-host, Jerome Osentowski of Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute in Basalt, Colorado. Tune in next month on KDNK on the third Monday of the month at 4 p.m. for another episode of Living Permaculture, where we'll hear part two of our interview with David Lipsky. We'll talk to you then. Pay.